May God
welcome
bless
back
you.
To Thank Real you. Science Radio. I'm Fred Williams, and today we're picking up right where we left off with compelling genetic evidence that confirms what the Bible has said all along. Adam and Eve were real historical people. In this second half of our conversation with Donnie and Matt from Standing for Truth Ministries, we'll walk through the cutting-edge mutation rate studies, the mitochondrial DNA clock, and the Y chromosome evidence that points directly back to our first parents. And then, stick around, because we're going to tackle the evolutionist's so-called best argument for common ancestry, endogenous retroviruses. Are they leftovers from our ape-like past, or part of God's original design? You'll want to hear this.
I'd like to cover something briefly, gentlemen, that I think will be fascinating to your audience. And perhaps Matt can expand on the significance of the observed mutation rate and how we can get these mutation rates from what's called pedigree studies, where we look at, for example, grandparents, parents, and kids. So if it's the mitochondrial DNA, you can look at grandmothers, mothers, daughters, count up the differences, and what you get is a fast rate. And the same thing is true for the Y chromosome. The rate is very fast, about 1 to 3 per generation. What the significance is for the origin of Adam and Eve, how far they go back, we can have Matt touch on. But here is some fascinating evidence that supports what Genesis 9:19 says. These are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole earth overspread. Well, right here is a mitochondrial DNA phylogenetic tree. What you can do, and specifically Dr. Nathaniel Jensen of AIG did this, he took mitochondrial DNA worldwide and he compared them in a phylogenetic tree like this. Mitochondrial DNA, it's what's called uniparentally inherited DNA, so it's only passed down on one side. Specifically the mother's side. It's outside of the nucleus. It's a smaller DNA compartment. It's about 16,500 letters long. It's involved in energy production. And we've been able to trace back all worldwide mitochondrial DNA to a single woman. But in terms of this phylogenetic tree, amazingly, what you'll notice is right in the middle, you'll have these, you see these three arrows. You've got three nodes. So what does the Bible say in Genesis 9:19? Well, the earth was overspread by three reproducing couples, right? You have the flood bottleneck, and you have Noah, his wife, their three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and their three wives. Those would be the daughters-in-law of Noah. Now, we just learned that mitochondrial DNA is inherited maternally. So if what the Bible says, again, in Genesis 9:19, if that's true, then in the mitochondrial DNA, we should be able to trace back all mitochondrial DNA to three main starting points. And in technical terms, what these are, the evolutionary community doesn't even contest this. These are the L, M, and N haplogroups, these three major nodes. And so on this tree, this is a phylogenetic tree, these lines, they represent DNA differences or mutations. And the lines separating, this is very interesting. The lines separating these three major nodes, they're short. Okay, so if the lines are mutations, that means these women here are only separated by a few mutations, less than 10 easily. The lines radiating out, as you can see, they're very long. A lot longer than the line separating L, M, and N. That means more time, more mutations, more diversity. So what is this tree representing? Well, I think it's amazing. You've got pre-flood mutations here. The three women that came off of the ark, specifically Shem, Ham, and Japheth's wives, and radiating out from them, are post-flood mutations, post-flood people, post-flood individuals and people groups. And so amazingly, we can trace back mitochondrial DNA to three major haplogroups. The Bible says that we've all come from three reproducing couples. To the evolutionist, this has to be a coincidence. But to the biblical creationists like us three, this is amazing confirmation of what Genesis says about human origins.
Amen. Good stuff.
Yeah, so everything's tracing back to three women. So how many women were on the ark?
Yeah, well, technically on the ark, good question. You have four, Noah's wife. So assuming that Noah and his wife didn't have any more daughters, then the three founding couples basically would be Shem, Ham, Japheth, and their three wives.
Yeah.
I think maybe we throw in an interesting aside. What do you say, Doug?
Oh, no. I don't know, Fred. I don't know if that's necessary. Is that really necessary at this point?
I wonder if it is, only because Dominic Inyart did a short on this topic. And so not on this, what we're talking about here, Donnie and Matt, but it's on the three daughters of Eve. I think that was the name of the paper that Dr. Carter, Rob Carter, did originally on this, which was fantastic. We totally agree. This is huge evidence for the Bible. But something that Bob, some research he had did that I just want to mention, it'll take about a minute. And why I say a minute, because I want to play a 1 minute short that Dominic Inyart did on this.
Yeah, that's great.
And that, so you had the four women on the ark. And so it gets to the question of the reason that Canaan was cursed. Are you guys familiar with this?
Fred, I think you and I briefly discussed this in our program together. Actually, Standing for Truth. So if it's what I'm thinking, then yes, this is an interesting point.
There could be a blurring of one of those three lines, and it seems like the science partially supports that. So I'm going to play this short real quick, the short from Dominic Inyart from Inyart Theology real quick. It's about a minute long, and I think it's a good thing to show you guys.
Why was Canaan cursed? Genesis chapter 9 records the story of Noah's son Ham. Remember, Noah was the guy with the ark in the global flood. And Moses records, quote, "Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father. As a result of this, Noah cursed Ham's son, Canaan. Canaan then became the head of Israel's primary enemies, the Canaanites." Needless to say, this story is bizarre. Why would Noah curse Ham's son because Ham looked at his nakedness? Well, it's not immediately clear, so it deserves some research. This phrase has caused much confusion, but when Christians learn its meaning, the entire chapter tells a much clearer yet unfortunate story. You see, quote unquote, "a man's nakedness" is an ancient Hebrew figure of speech. Essentially, it's a polite way of referring to sexual intercourse with a man's wife.
I've actually heard that before. And one thing I can add to that is that maybe that was in the Bible why Noah was never again mentioned talking to his wife before. So,
well, interesting. Yeah. So for those who, just to make sure the audience knows what we're talking about, if this account, as Dominic Inyart explained it, is correct, which I thoroughly believe it is, I mean, it's very well documented in the Bible, as this figure of speech. What it means is that Ham slept with his mom and produced Canaan. Hmm. And so we've believed that there actually is a blurring of these three lines that came from, you know, the daughters of Eve, so to speak, that there's maybe three or four.
Right.
And that's why I wanted to bring this up.
And this, our haplogroup right here, some have argued, one could say there's some in-house debate on how to interpret this phylogenetic tree. If there was a third line from Noah's family, then this haplogroup here, R, could also represent one of those women. So you'd have three, possibly four. And so regardless of what view or hypothesis is true, what do we have? We still have confirmation of what the Bible is saying, because you've got three, four max. Some have argued that this represents a post-Babel dispersal event, which is interesting as well. But like you said, and then also Dominic, that if there's a fourth lineage, that fourth lineage could be here. R. Now, the line separating L, M, and N when you bring in R is a little longer, so we'd have to interpret that, but still not as long as your other lines, which again is representing DNA differences or mutations over time. And so one could interpret the tree with that view. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah. And the bottom line, even though we don't have all the facts yet, although I do believe genetic science will advance to the point one day to catch up with the Bible and help explain the Bible. And I'm excited to see that happen and appreciate the work that you guys have done already. But before we go on, I just want to thank Dominic Enyart, Fred, because when you said it was time for an interesting aside, I thought you were going to hit me with the interesting fact of the week, and I thought I had made it at least through the radio broadcast without being embarrassed by the interesting fact of the week, and we should probably move on to another topic right now.
So you don't think we should do the interesting fact? I think we should. I think this is the perfect spot for it. So, Doug, are you ready for the interesting fact of the week? And this one's a little bit of a softball. I think you can get this one, but it could stump you because just being under pressure. And then if it does, we'll give Donnie and Matt a shot.
All right.
All right, so here is the interesting fact of the week. Which part of the human body is named after the first man in the Bible?
Oh... let's see, the first man in the Bible being Adam, created from the dust of the ground. The Adam's apple.
Let's do it again.
Hey, there you go, Doug.
You got it.
Yes! So Donnie
makes
and Matt,
sense after you hear it.
Donnie and Matt, just so you know, whenever we have more than two guests, Bob always gives me a softball because he's I'm sorry, did I say Bob?
Yeah.
Anyway, Fred always gives me a softball because he's merciful and he tries to be generous, especially in larger groups of people.
He's a merciful host.
Yeah. That's
appreciate
right.
Appreciate that about you, Fred. Okay, so what does the Bible demand? Earlier we read that the Bible is clear. God creates two people, Adam, Eve, Adam the first man, Eve the mother of all living. They're unrelated to any other form of life. That includes chimpanzees, our so-called closest cousin on the evolutionary phylogenetic tree of life, and banana plants. Well, the Bible demanded a single woman that every human being has descended from. The evolutionary model did not predict this. If evolution were true, we did not have to originate from a single man and a single woman. As a matter of fact, if we went into detail on the Out of Africa theory, we would have every reason to believe there should have been multiple mitochondrial DNA lineages, multiple Y chromosome lineages. But again, take every single male Y chromosome, that's the paternally inherited DNA compartment, passed down on the father's side. I have my father's Y chromosome. And there's very little variation. Every single male Y chromosome is nearly identical in its genetic makeup, can be traced back to a single man. Same thing with the mitochondrial DNA. They're both very different from chimpanzee. For example, if you consider overall size differences, gene content, and architecture, the chimpanzee and human Y chromosomes are less than 30% the same. They're nothing alike. But the Bible demanded a single woman, a single man, and we've discovered this single woman and single man, Eve, and specifically when it comes to the Y chromosome Noah. Now, Matt, I want you to take it from here. Mutation rates. In the scientific literature, the conventional literature, this is the evolutionary, this is their Bible in many ways. They admit that the observed mutation rate is much faster than the so-called phylogenetic rate that evolutionists look to. As you can see here from this paper, tenfold the observed mutation rate, tenfold higher than phylogenetically derived rates. This is the Parsons paper. Matt, what is the significance of this specific paper, but also other papers related to the mutation rate in mitochondrial DNA? What does that tell us about the origin of Eve and mankind in general?
this was one of the largest studies that was ever done at its time, the first one, because Parsons worked for the FBI, and he gathered 10 of the best geneticists from around the world and got them together and said, let's run a mutation rate and a substitution rate. Substitution rate is just a worldwide population version. And let's determine when the first woman converged from this. How long ago did she actually live? The most recent common ancestor of all women alive today. And as you can see from this, the mutation rate he got was about 20 times higher than expected. Really, really fast, and put the Eve living about 6,500 years ago. And the critics didn't like this. They didn't believe it. And one of his biggest critics named Holland said, I'll run that test again with you. And so the following year, in 1998, he joined the team. They ran the numbers again from a different bunch of blood, all from the FBI database, usually from people that died in war. And they gathered up all the blood, and sure enough, the mutation rate was even faster than the first one. They said, okay, well, you know, something will explain this later in the future, probably. We don't know what that is, but we'll eventually get a slower rate that'll match evolution. Years went by. And in 2022, they ran another pedigree study. This is the most recent one in humans, got the same rate. We will look at what Nathaniel Jensen found, because what he was talking about was the Eve's consensus sequence, which is mitochondrial, that takes us back to the first woman. But he was also talking about the Y chromosome. So when Nathaniel Jensen at Answers in Genesis came along, and he started reading through the published peer-reviewed papers, and the first ones that were done on pedigree mutation rates, they scanned the Y chromosome and didn't see very many mutations. So they said, see, it's really slow. It points back to about 300,000 years ago. And so what happens is two other studies came out. You can see them right here. They were pedigree rate studies as well. But they did something different. They scanned the Y chromosome multiple times, called high sequence data scanning. And what they noticed is they missed hundreds of mutations. And by missing those hundreds of mutations, they actually found that there was actually 3 mutations per person per generation. That's extremely fast. But they hid this. They hid it in the supplemental data. That's why if you find it right here, it says that the difference was about tenfold faster. That's exactly what Parsons discovered, isn't it? Exactly the same. So they hid this in the supplemental form, and they said, this prompted us to explore additional filters, meaning we didn't like this at all. This does not align with evolution. What did it align with? Well, the observed rate, 3 mutations on average. The average person has 440 mutation differences. So that takes us back only 146 generations before we land around Noah. So depending on the generation time you want to give him, that 30 years takes us back 4,380 years. 35 years takes us back 5,100. That's not evolutionary timeline. That's not 300,000 years. So then Nathaniel Jensen said, I have a better idea. Let's compare this to the Native American history going over from the Red Record and see if it can align with something. So what he noticed is that Native Americans they track time by something called a sachems. Sachems are how long a Native American chief lives. So it's not a constant number. It can be 15 years and then he dies of a heart attack, or it could be 50 years because he lived his entire age. So he tracked how many sachems it was to that, and it matched his mutation rate. And here's another thing that's cool. Not only did he confirm it with history, he also said, well, how many mutations until we notice that the haplogroups form and they branch out in the Y chromosome? And sure enough, taking it 3 mutations per generation, you land on Peleg, exactly where the dispersion happened in the Tower of Babel. So how cool. And where? It's in the Middle East. Wait a minute. I thought people originated in Africa. How come all the haplogroups formed in the Middle East, in the biblical area? That makes no sense, right? Think about it. People are living 150,000 years in Africa, and a haplogroup just means when you're living in a small group, a mutation will arise, and it'll pass around till everybody in that tribe or population has it. That's a new haplogroup. So Africa, full of people, full of tribes, for hundreds of thousands of years, and all of a sudden the haplogroups only waited to form until they left Africa? Yeah, I don't think so. That's nonsense. But don't worry, we have even more information, because another study said that it looks like science has confirmed that the human genome began to rapidly diverge not more than 5,000 years ago. So wait, if we're living in Africa and we're diverging as people, it should go back hundreds of thousands. We don't see that. Instead, when we look at Africa, we only find a few haplogroups, not very many at all. But what do we do find when we look? We found the structures of Noah's 16 grandchildren. How interesting is that? Literal places with literal people. And if we have time, I can tell you a story about William H. Shea,
Okay, so wait a minute here. Okay, so Matt, you said that everybody goes back, you look at these genealogies and everything traces back to the first pirate, right? Pegleg. Oh, wait, no, you said Pegleg. Okay, my bad. So, okay, so I digress. So who's this guy you wanted to talk about, Matt?
This was an interesting person that I found when I was looking for physical evidence of biblical patriarchs. This man in the middle is named William H. Shea, and he was got his PhD in Loma Linda, California, and he was an explorer and loved to travel. And what he did is he thought to himself, let's go to the Middle East. Why not? This is some of the first history arose in the Fertile Crescent. So what he did is he traveled up to Turkey and went to Mount Ararat. And while he was there, he was documenting his trip and said, I have a guide to take me around. Show me some of this historical stuff. So after Mount Ararat, he looked around. He saw some interesting things, but nothing that really stood out. So what he did is he went over and said, the tour guide said, I think you're going to like Mount Carey. It's a very interesting place and it's not too far away, just a little bit kind of north from here. So they took him up and he took him to what's called Mount Ararat. And Mount Ararat looks like this on the satellite GPS, by the way. This is a Google Earth. And so when they got there, they got out and they looked at the beautiful terrain and they said, let's scout and go up the mountain. And he said, all right, so they did a little tour up to the top of the mountain, and when they came back down, he said, look at this. Look on the top of this mountain over here. I think there's something up there. I kind of see it, and if you zoom in just a little bit, you can see there is something up there. He said, can we go back and look at that? And they said, sure, but we have to travel around. We can hike around it. He said, can't we just do the perimeter of the lake? It'll be a little bit faster. They completely agreed. And on his travel walking around, he noticed on the stones that there was an interesting writing. And because this was a specialty, he said, that's proto-Semitic. This is the first writing system of mankind. What's that doing here? This shouldn't be here at all. And he noticed a couple of the letters, and they kept moving. And he said, this is interesting. This kind of is showing me that there's like a map. It's guiding us somewhere. So what he did is they walked along the beach a little bit further, and he came up on a giant rock. It looked like this. And in it, he noticed there were some images. So he traced it, and he drew this. And he noticed it has a dove on one side, a raven on another, with an ark right here with people on it. There's faces, and there's a group of people down here that says Japheth, Shem, and Ham. And so highlighted rock, it's a little bit more like this. You can thank AI for doing that for me. And it was amazing. He found this rock that seemed to portray the exact story of what was going on with the ark. And after he read it, he said, the ark landed here. Very interesting. So now he's on to something, and they're not even to their destination yet. So they keep walking, and he goes up, and the top of the mountain is actually tombs, and there's tombs everywhere. But here's the view looking down at the parking lot. It's got a cross on it now, and there's a bunch of piled up rocks. That's a gravesite. And this fascinated him to no end. And one thing that he really couldn't believe is when they started to look at specific rocks, he came across a stone that had a face of a man on it and a hole in it. And when you look through the hole, it points at the mountain on the other side of the lake. And written on it, it says Noah and tomb. And he was like, I can't believe this. This is amazing. This is unbelievable. So the tour guide said, we actually have one more stop to do. We can come back to this if you like. So they got in their vehicle and they journeyed. He said, I want to show you the Armenian Stonehenge. So they traveled and they got to the Armenian Stonehenge. They got out and sure enough, he saw the same writing yet again. This is that proto-Sindaric inscriptions that they find in certain places of the world that's really old. The origin of writing, actually. So they got out and he noticed more writing. And he said, wow, this has Shem and his wife's name on it, including others. There were other people that weren't mentioned in scripture, but he noticed that their names were also inscribed on these rocks. And something very fascinating, one of the stones has Shem's and his wife's name on it, and right in the middle is a tomb. And on the other side over here, a little off the screen, is another tomb. He literally found Shem's grave and his wife's. And I found it interesting that the other one he didn't get a chance to go back to. He would have actually probably been able to identify Noah's tomb. Now, this fascinated me, and I looked online, and I found out his information. He lives over here in Palm Desert, California, by me, and I wanted to go see him. So I found this, and I emailed, and unfortunately, his wife responded to me and said he died in 2000. So all of his research and everything, she couldn't access because she's 87 years old and couldn't do it. So the best I could get were the stories that I found online, and I found it fascinating that we have physical evidence leading us to these tombs and graves and never really been investigated much because this guy found it and posted it online, but it's in a different language. So I just really like that story, and I can't believe I can't find my picture.
Well, it's interesting and fascinating stuff, and what it points to, whether or not it's all genuine, maybe we don't know, but what it does point to is a knowledge of the story going back very far with people in that land, and the fact, it just highlights the fact that every civilization on the planet has some sort of flood story, which also tells us that all those flood stories are derived from something that actually happened, and that's what the Bible tells us. And so I think that's what I'm convinced. Adam and Eve, yeah, real. Absolutely. And I appreciate the fact that there are people working in genetics to try to catch up with Genesis and Matthew and 2 Corinthians. I love it. Eventually they will catch up. And you guys will be there, and hopefully us too, to document as much of it as we can. But now I want to talk about, well, and we might not have time today, but we'll have you guys back to talk about endogenous retroviruses. I want to hear more about that, because with that many syllables, there's got to be a lot of people in the audience who absolutely want to know what is that all about.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a great question, Doug. I will put up some visuals showing exactly why this argument from, and you said it, you nailed it, endogenous retroviruses. If you were to search on YouTube or Google, what's the best evidence for evolution? What typically comes up is endogenous retroviruses. Now, what endogenous retroviruses are claimed to be are shared viral-like sequences in the biological world. So they'll say, well, humans and chimpanzees share these viral-like sequences that they call ERVs, and therefore they must have inherited those from a common ancestor. So they'll say humans and chimps have a common ancestor going back about 6 million years ago, and there must have been ancient viral infections that were passed on to both lineages. And I like to ask the question, are these sequences, this supposed viral DNA, are they really the ancient remnants of past viral infection, or are they created units of DNA function? Now, I wrote a book called The Endogenous Retrovirus Handbook, examining that question and examining this argument in detail. In my book and presentations, I've also formally debated the topic many times with proponents of evolution, and I've documented dozens and dozens of papers directly in the secular literature showing the amazing functionality of these endogenous retroviruses. They function, and here's just a few, and then I want to go over some of my favorite papers on the issue. And so ERVs are playing an antiviral role in the genome. So in many ways, some of these ERVs are our antiviral programs like you have in a computer. They will fight off exogenous retroviruses. So there's a difference between endogenous, that means it's occurring from within. Exogenous would be like the HIV virus. It's occurring horizontally or externally, external infection. And so these ERVs act to fight off viral infections. And as a matter of fact, to do so, they have to share the sequence similarity with the exogenous retroviruses, because evolutionists will oftentimes argue, they'll challenge us. They'll say, okay, if these ERVs are not really the ancient vestiges of past viral infection, why do they look like retroviruses? The way they're made up, the structure, they're made up with what's called long terminal repeats, LTRs, GAG, POL, and ENV components. It's the same makeup as a retrovirus, but it turns out, gentlemen, that in order for these ERVs which are created units of DNA function, the majority of them, in order for them to carry out many of their operational roles, they have to look like retroviruses. They also function in determining cell types, regulating gene expression. But here's one of the most amazing functions. Notice this. Directly from the conventional literature, this is what they say. HERVs, if there's an H, that's human-specific ERV, appear to play important roles in physiology, fetal development, and of course they got to throw it in there, that's their assumption, human evolution, they say. If the accidental infection, so firstly, you got to be able to read between the lines in these technical papers. If the accidental infection, well, they're assuming that an infection occurred millions of years ago, but let's continue, of a mammalian ancestor by an exogenous retrovirus, so they argue that in the ancient past, our ancestors were infected with exogenous retroviruses, and then those were passed down vertically through the germ cell line and became endogenous retroviruses. But they say if this had never occurred, the placenta and the mammals that produce it, including humans, would have never existed. So what this is saying is that ERVs play important roles in embryological development, that if we did not have these ERVs, we would not exist. Gentlemen, I like to exist. I think you all like to exist. And so the easy answer to the question, why do we share endogenous retroviral-like sequences with the biological world, let's say chimpanzees, is the same reason why all modes of transportation have engines in common. Because you need these DNA units to live, to function, to exist in the first place. A car without an engine is not going to get very far. And we require these DNA elements for embryological development. This paper right here is incredible. This is from 2021. More and more are they finding these functional roles for these ERVs. This one's called Switching Sides, How Endogenous Retroviruses Protect Us from Viral Infections, Long Disregarded as Junk DNA or Genomic Dark Matter. So they once assumed that these were non-functional junk. That's what they're saying. No functions. This is just viral DNA. These are evolutionary leftovers. But is that really the case, gentlemen? The answer is no. They're admitting this right in the conventional literature. They are refuting their best evidence for us. So they say ERVs have turned out to represent important components of the antiviral immune response. Not only do they regulate cell immune activation, but may even directly target invading pathogens. And they have a focus here in recent advances in acting as regulators of antiviral gene expression. That's incredible. Their so-called best evidence for evolution, we're finding function after function that if we did not have these ERVs, we wouldn't survive. So what is, or we wouldn't even exist. What's the best explanation? I argue common design, not common design.
Right. Yeah. Wouldn't it make more sense to assume that these are common tools? Or I shouldn't say tools, I suppose. These are common components taken from the toolbox of the designer to perform certain functions. That certainly seems as reasonable to be pursued as the idea that it was an accidental viral infection. That's almost like saying the viruses designed us? What exactly?
Well, you know, guys, so Donna, you mentioned the word functional a lot of times. I remember years ago, many years ago, and I want to say late 90s, early 2000s, when I first heard this argument, maybe it was somewhere around there, that they had a little bit of evidence for function, but their big premise was that they didn't have function. That's what I remember. And wasn't it, it was kind of also related to the whole shared mistakes thing, but the ERVs, I remember at the time saying, you know, if we find function, what are you guys going to say? Because they were already finding a little bit. And so now, you know, fast forward another 20 years, and here you are, Donnie, showing the actual scientific literature. The evolutionists themselves are finding this function in these ERVs, and it totally demolishes their argument.
Amen. You nailed it. I mean, there's still many militant evolutionists that believe the majority of the genome is junk. Even though that idea has been completely overturned, junk DNA is junk science. Here we have the ENCODE projects. There's been many sophisticated projects looking at the incredible function of the genome. And notice this from 2012. These data enabled us to assign biochemical functions for 80% of the genome. Now, what militant evolutionists would say is, well, okay, we have 80% biochemical activity, but the majority of that activity, because they have the evolutionary mindset, the assumptions, they'll say that must be noise or spurious. So it's not really beneficial or functional activity. But I say that doesn't make sense logically or scientifically, because transcription, that's an energy and resource intensive process. Every time you add, Fred, a single nucleotide to a growing RNA chain, what you're consuming is energy. You're utilizing ATP. And so if the majority of this activity really were junk or spurious or just noise and not reflective of true beneficial function, then evolutionary mechanisms over time should have weeded out all of this excess genetic baggage, because it would be what? It would be wasteful of energy and resources for the cell. So the fact that it's still there, this activity is still present, tells us that this activity is beneficial activity. And within this activity, gentlemen, what do we find? We find pseudogenes, these so-called genetic scars or genetic mistakes. We find ERVs. And that suggests that even in the units that we haven't really found the exact function for, there is a function that we have to do more study, more research, and discover exactly what that function is, because we're just in the infancy of understanding the DNA language. But as creationists, we can make testable predictions, can't we? We can predict as the years go on, we're going to discover more and more functional roles for these so-called evolutionary leftovers.
Yeah, many in our audience probably remember going back to, I think, 1997, Bob Inyart was debating Eugenie Scott, and he asked her, what's your best evidence for evolution? Well, she said junk DNA. Mm-hmm. And he goes, well, how much do you think we really know about the genome? Like, do you think it's 5%? Do you think it's 50? Do you think it's 90? And she's like, oh, we know about everything we're going to know. I mean, and you know, then now again, you fast forward again, you got guys like Dr. Francis Collins, who ran ENCODE, didn't he, guys? He ran that, I know he was the director of the NIH, and he apologized for calling it junk DNA. He came out and he apologized and said, this is not junk DNA. It's pretty much, we think it's probably 100% functional.
I don't think we've been able to get a hold of Eugenie to solicit an apology. Although we wouldn't solicit an apology. We would just hope that she would feel compelled to make an apology, but we have not been able to get a hold of her lately.
Yep.
I bet
not. Well, to say back then that we know everything that we could ever know about DNA function is flabbergasting. I don't know how anybody could today still hold on to this junk DNA paradigm. Right in their papers, gentlemen, I cited this paper earlier about ERVs in 2021. In the paper here, I have an excerpt. Notice what they say. Our knowledge about endogenous retroviral elements involved in cell immune responses is what? Constantly increasing. So do we know everything that we could ever know about DNA function? No. That knowledge is constantly increasing. Every year we come out with more and more functions for pseudogenes, ERVs. I have a number of papers in this slideshow going over the functional roles for pseudogenes. They're necessary to sustain healthy life processes in the cell, but many over the years have said pseudogenes, ERVs, these are really just irrefutable. I heard one evolutionist say that because in science we don't really prove things, it's about disproving things. But he said, I've heard prominent evolutionists say that ERVs are as close as you can get to proof for something. But as we can see, no, ERVs are just yet more confirmation of design.
Yeah, and real quick, Donnie, to be fair to Eugenie Scott and to many of these other scientists, in their actual work, when they're actually doing the work of compiling evidence and analyzing genomics, they won't say that they know everything, and they won't say that it's really proof of anything. It seems to me they only say that in the context of defending evolution. That's right. When they become clowns and not scientists. The rest of the day, they're scientists, but you get them in to consider the possibility of a creator, especially a creator who will judge them for their sins and wants to restrain their sexual lasciviousness. That's when they become clownish. Otherwise, they're good scientists.
Well, she's a militant anti-theist. She runs the Freedom From Religion organization that if you wanted to get creationist content taught in schools, she's the first one to sue you as an individual. Mm-hmm. So that explains that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's religion. It's not science, bottom line.
Well, that's why I like to say you find the best rebuttals, gentlemen, to evolutionary arguments like ERVs directly in the secular literature. Because that's when they're doing their science. Yes, in the discussion section or conclusion sections of these papers, they do oftentimes have to put forth rescue devices or rescue mechanisms. Like for ERVs, for example, they'll say, well, these functions were co-opted or evolved over time. My challenge to the evolutionary community is show me a non-functional endogenous retrovirus going from non-functional to something incredibly functional in, let's say, embryological development. and you won't find a paper showing that. As a matter of fact, there's incredible research going on right now. This is one of my favorite new functions that they've discovered, that ERVs are acting in tumor suppression, where transcribed ERVs in the cell give the cell the appearance of being invaded by a harmful exogenous retrovirus in tumor cells. And so the immune system, this whole process is amazingly mediated by what's called the P53 protein. Okay, this is the guardian of the genome, the superhero protein of the genome, many call it. And this whole process is mediated by the P53 protein. The immune system targets that tumor cell with destruction to destroy it, because it looks like through what's called viral mimicry that cell is being invaded by a virus. And so this is just one of the many functions for the ERV. So when the evolutionists ask, well, why do ERVs look like retroviruses? They have to look like retroviruses to carry out these functional roles, because their function in viral mimicry wouldn't be very effective if they didn't look like the retrovirus that they're trying to mimic. It would be like if I wanted to infiltrate the mob as an FBI agent, am I going to show up in my FBI uniform? Hey, here I am, name tag and badge and everything. No, I'd have to play the part, right? I'd have to look like a mobster, somebody who's not actually an FBI agent. And that's what a lot of these ERVs are doing as they fight off tumors, as they fight off invading viruses. This is all incredible evidence for common design, not common descent.
Yes, and that's a great analogy. That helps me understand exactly what's going on here.
Yeah, so guys, man, what powerful evidence. I love this whole ERV thing. It's come a long way since I first heard that argument. I can't believe they're still using that as their number one argument. So guys, man, I really appreciate you coming on the show and going through this stuff. And I know there's so many more topics we could talk about. It's never ending. Donnie and Matt, you guys got a great program going over there, Standing for Truth Ministries. You've had a lot of great guests. I'm looking forward to a lot more and a lot of your live debates and a lot of good live discussions. So we encourage our audience to go subscribe to their channel and tune into their live debates. And you can leave comments. You can comment during the show. You can even, you know what, toss in a buck or two and you can get your comment all the way to the top and get read.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, Fred, you experienced that. We had a pretty extensive Q&A, didn't we?
Yeah,
brother, when you joined me.
Yeah, so, you know, we just had a really good show with Pete Moore on Special Relativity. So maybe you guys can have him on. And to me, that's a really interesting topic, too. Very controversial, you know, among creationists, too. So.
Oh, that's funny you mentioned that, Fred. I brought that subject up to a professional colleague, college educated, MD level education. She said, yeah, you know, there's more and more people are questioning relativity. And she's not a Christian or anything like that, but she wasn't shocked by it. And so I sent her a link and I hope to follow up with her on that. And someday, Donnie and Matt, I hope that I'll interact with professional colleagues who'll say, yeah, you know, more and more people are just, they're questioning Darwin. It's just not working anymore. So we all keep doing what we can. And I love your tactic of taking out of their own words, like you said, when they're doing their real science is the best time to find the refutations right. of their clownish evolutionary claims. And I love your tactics. And, man, appreciate you guys coming on and sharing it with us and our audience. And where do you go from here? What's next on your agenda? Is there anything big you guys have in the kitty coming down?
It's a great question. We always have active research projects. I mean, endogenous retroviruses are still an active research project. Because now I'm working on, I just put out a presentation on the origin of retroviruses in general, just focusing on the bigger picture question. Because I like to ask the evolutionists this, Doug and Fred, okay, what's the true origin of retroviruses? Because the evolution community, they have what's called a chicken and egg problem. Retroviruses actually require a host to replicate. So what came first, the host or the retrovirus? Oh, wait a minute, if you don't have a host or a pre-existing cell, then the retrovirus has no way to replicate. And so I have an active research project investigating that answer. And, you know, I've got some good research suggesting that retroviruses have originated from within genomes after the fall due to degeneration, so on and so forth. So working on that, Matt and I just finished a marathon of a debate with a prominent evolutionist, Culture Katz, on Adam and Eve. So if you want to see, those in the audience, the viewer, if you want to see how an informed evolutionist might respond to some of this evidence, I'd recommend going to watch that debate. We're very happy with the debate. Who made the best arguments? Who made the worst arguments? We'll leave that up to the viewer, of course. And so, yeah.
Well, the fact that you're promoting it, I have a feeling I know who won.
Well, easy. I'll say this. It's a great time to be a biblical creationist, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. We also have something called Truth in Research, where we now do publish papers. And I just submitted three for Donnie to go through. One of them is the spreading of the seafloor and how the actual ages from radiometric dating prove biblical young earth creation time. Not the evolutionary timeline that they say, hundreds of millions of years, from the published peer-reviewed literature. That's where I found it. They hit it yet again. Surprise, okay. Surprise. So a lot of papers coming out as well. We're always busy.
Yeah. Hydroplate Theory Conference next month. Fred, you're going to be part of that. So that's our next big conference. We do try to do
a
conference or seminar every couple months. And so I am excited for that. Matt's going to be co-hosting that with me. We're going to have a rigorous discussion. Fred's going to be present, Brian Lauer. So there's an event to look forward to in our future.
Outstanding. Well, we'll put a link up to all your stuff, gentlemen. Thank you so much. God bless your efforts. Godspeed. And we really appreciate it.
All right.
God bless. It was a privilege.
Yep. Thank you, guys. Again, Standing for Truth Ministries. You definitely got to go check their channel out. Please subscribe to them. And they've got, again, some great debates and a lot of good content. So... for Donnie and Matt of Standing for Truth Ministries, I'm Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. And also, I almost forgot my co-host, Doug McBurney. So, Doug is in his new digs. Check out his new studio, everybody.
Yeah.
He's in his new studio, finally, after a long process. But that's what happens when you live in California, right, Doug?
That's right. They put you through the ringer every which way. But we managed to outsmart them, and we actually put up a warehouse and studios and global headquarters. Yes, we'll be inviting people down to visit the headquarters soon. Thanks, Fred.
All righty. Thanks again, guys. May God bless you.
Thank you.
Take care.